John 18, beginning verse 28. Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas into the praetorium, and it was early. And they themselves did not enter into the praetorium, so that they would not be defiled, but might eat the Passover. Therefore Pilate went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" And they answered and said to him, "If this man were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him to you." So Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and judge him according to your law." The Jews said to him, "We are not permitted to put anyone to death." John indicates in verse 32 that this was to fulfill the word of Jesus which he spoke, signifying by what kind of death he was about to die. Therefore Pilate entered again into the praetorium and summoned Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus answered, "Are you saying this on your own initiative, or did others tell you about me?" And Pilate answered, "I am not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and the chief priests delivered you to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I would not be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm." Therefore Pilate said to him, "So you are a king." Jesus answered, "You say correctly that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" And when he had said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, "I find no guilt in him." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. It's that time of year, that season that comes around every several years where political fervor and rhetoric are intensifying as we have debates and jockeying for posture going into a presidential election year coming up next year. And the pressure seems to be on to pick your candidate and line up with him or her or against certain candidates. And on social media, at least, I mean, one stance on a particular candidate can alienate you. It can infuriate others. And it's really amazing to see that people feel so strongly committed and identified with certain individuals on matters which, at this point in the thing, it's entirely possible to be undecided and even somewhat indifferent. At the end of our lives, it ultimately will not matter one iota which candidate you backed going into the primaries, and ultimately it will not matter which ones you voted for or against, as the case may be. As important as the issues are, at this point, it is okay to be undecided. It's okay to be somewhat indifferent. But there are other matters on which it's always impossible to be indifferent or undecided. We may have to, in wisdom, withhold judgment for now on which Republican or which Democrat would be the best leader for our nation. But when it comes to what we will do with Jesus Christ in our lives, the decision is urgent and it must be made. It cannot be ignored. It cannot be put off. It cannot be avoided. He said himself, Matthew 12:20, "He who is not with me is against me." There are infinite and eternal consequences, and Jesus has removed the option of taking a middle ground. A decision has to be made. Nowhere is that more evident in Scripture than in our text here today. Following the informal interrogation before Annas, who you may remember is the man with the real religious authority in Jerusalem, and then the more formal arraignment before Caiaphas, the man who held the position of high priest. Caiaphas held the position, Annas held the power. Now the Jewish authorities bring Jesus to Pontius Pilate at the praetorium. The praetorium is a word that refers to the headquarters of the Roman government in any subjected province. And Pilate, as the prefect of Judea, was normally headquartered in Caesarea. He lived there and worked there out of a palace that Herod the Great had built for himself decades earlier. But during religious festivals, such as Passover, which was going on at this time, Pilate and other Roman leaders would migrate to Jerusalem to keep a heavy hand on the surging population of pilgrims that came into the city at this time of nationalistic and religious fervor. And so while in Jerusalem, the praetorium was likely the fortress of Antonia, just steps away from the outer court of the Jerusalem temple. And this is where they brought Jesus. And it says they brought him early. They'd convened all night long in the adjoining palaces of Annas and Caiaphas. And at first light, or just before, they bring Jesus to Pilate. The Romans divided up the night into four watches. The third watch was called cock crow because of the regularity of roosters crowing between 3 and 6 a.m. I know in the cartoons, the rooster always crows when the sun comes up. If you've ever tried to sleep around roosters, you know that they don't wait for the sun to come up. So from 3 to 6 a.m. was called cock crow. But then the watch that began at 6 a.m. was just called early. It was just called early. And so this was about the time that the Jewish officials showed up with Jesus at the praetorium. When it says that they came early, verse 28, it was early. That's actually a pretty specific way of referring to the time of day. This was about the time that a Roman official would begin his day, sometime around sunrise or just before, so that they could have matters wrapped up by lunchtime, middle of the day, something like that. Now, the Jewish authorities who were bringing Jesus before Pilate viewed this matter as a mere formality. You know, let's go jump through this hoop, and we already know the verdict is certain. We're going to go over here. It'll be a slam dunk. We just make the presentation of Jesus to Pilate. He will rubber stamp our wishes, and Jesus will be off to death. We've got these trumped up charges against him. All we have to do is get Pilate to nod and sign off, and then Jesus will be dead. That was their thinking. Now, Pilate was a harsh and a cruel man, and they must have assumed that killing one more Jew would be something that he would maybe even find pleasure in doing. But Pilate was also an unpredictable man. Just when you think you've got him figured out, he stumps you. And so perhaps he was offended by their presumptiveness. Perhaps he was paranoid of creating an uprising. We also know from Matthew's gospel that the night before, Pilate's wife had had a nightmare concerning this person, Jesus. And she warned him to have nothing to do with him. Or for some reason, Pilate shows a surprising measure of restraint and an unpredictable impartiality here. He insists on there being a fresh hearing in his presence. And in what appears to be an uncharacteristic stand for justice, Pilate actually entraps himself in the impossibility of being indifferent to Jesus Christ. He becomes an example to us all that we ultimately must decide to be for him or against him. And so how do we make that kind of decision? Well, Pilate actually followed the right course, but he ultimately faltered in the conclusion. However, his footprints along the right course are enough to help us come to the place of decision for ourselves. What shall we do with Jesus? And the first thing we discover is that we must consider Jesus for ourselves. We must consider him for ourselves. Any of you like Indian food? I love Indian food. I love it. Now, if you'd asked me 10 or 15 years ago if I liked Indian food, I would have said, no, I don't like it at all. I hate it, in fact. But if you'd really probed and asked more questions, you would have discovered that I'd never had it. I'd heard other people say that they didn't like Indian food, so I figured I better not try it. One time I was on a flight and they offered curry chicken as the dinner, and I just gave it back to the flight attendant. I didn't even want to taste it because I just was convinced that I was not going to like it. But other than that incident on the flight, the closest I'd ever come to Indian food was watching the dinner scene in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. And that was enough to convince me I didn't want to eat Indian food. But after I was put in a situation where I had no other choice but to eat Indian food, I realized that, no, they don't bring out monkey heads on plates, and no, there are not bugs and reptiles all over the menu. This is actually really good food. Indiana Jones had lied to me, and all the other people I'd listened to had led me astray, and now I try to make up for lost time and try to eat it as often as I can. But I had to make a decision for myself, not rest on the decisions of others. I mean, of course, it really doesn't matter whether I like Indian food or you like Indian food. That really is a matter of no consequence. But it matters a great deal what we do with Jesus. And when it comes to answering that question, we have to decide for ourselves. Deciding for yourself means that you're refusing to be persuaded by the baseless claims of others. Notice that when Pilate went out to the authorities who brought Jesus to him, he said, "What accusation do you bring against this man? What are the charges? What did he do?" And notice their answer. "If this man were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him to you." In what conceivable way does that answer Pilate's question? It doesn't. What they're saying is, "Oh, we've got our charges, all right, but you just have to trust us, okay? He's guilty of them all." Well, what are they? Don't you worry about that. We've already taken care of that. The fact was, they didn't have any charges to bring against Jesus, and they knew it. They'd bribed a couple of fellows along the way, according to the other Gospels, to make up some charges, but even their testimonies couldn't agree with each other. What the fact was is they built a theological case against Jesus because he had defied their traditions and personally offended them, but they knew that they didn't have a leg to stand on when it came to persuading Pilate to put this man to death. So they tried to dodge the question. Their claims were ultimately baseless. We find the same thing in the religious rhetoric of our own day. People speak out against Christ and against Christianity, sometimes with loud, venomous ire, and they expect people will just mindlessly follow along. Well, before you do that, ask some questions. What has Jesus done or not done to make you despise him so? In what way have you found Jesus to fail you? In what way have you definitively disproven his claims? What historical errors have you personally discovered in the gospel accounts of his life and ministry? Well, friends, most often, though they might get louder and more animated, they will not actually be able to answer those questions. Many of them have themselves been persuaded by the baseless claims, perhaps of a college professor that they were intimidated by a friend whom they admired or a family member whom they respected. But they've not considered Jesus for themselves, and they want you to just follow along in their folly. Well, like the Jewish officials before Pilate, they made baseless claims that they cannot substantiate about Jesus. And if you would consider Jesus for yourself, you would not be persuaded by those. Deciding for yourself also means that you won't be persuaded by the biased claims of others. The Jewish authorities had a reason to reject Jesus. They just didn't have a good one. He had exposed them. He exposed their hypocrisy. He exposed their sin through his teachings and through his encounters with them. And he cast a shadow on their reputation, which thus threatened their power and their influence over the people. They had tried, but they couldn't outreason him, either with human logic or with Holy Scripture. So their only recourse to silence him was to kill him. Now, Jesus knew that. And he knew that they intended to do this. And he had warned his disciples numerous times in advance, "This is what's going to happen when we get to Jerusalem. They're going to kill me." At various points along the way, he even alluded to the manner of his death, speaking about if I be lifted up, when I am lifted up, referring obliquely to the Roman torture of crucifixion. But the Jews could not carry that out without Pilate. When the Roman Empire conquered a land, one of the first things that they did was take away that government's power to execute criminals so that only Rome could sign off on execution. And so in order to get Jesus dead, they have to get Pilate to okay it. So they say, we are not permitted to put anyone to death. And John says, this is to fulfill what Jesus said about the kind of death he was about to die. They're going to lift him up from the earth on the cross. The hypocrisy of these people had been exposed by Jesus several times over the preceding 3 years, but you can even see it here. And notice in verse 28 that they wouldn't even go into the praetorium so that they wouldn't be defiled so that they could eat the Passover. I mean, they're very concerned about their ritual purity. If they go into a Gentile's residence, they'll be defiled. And depending on how they interpret the traditions, it could take up a week to be cleansed from that defilement. And the Passover was going on right then, and they wouldn't be able to eat the meal. Very concerned about ritual purity, but they think nothing of killing an innocent man on made-up charges, violating nearly every tenet of the law that they claim to uphold, not to mention the hypocrisy of their pandering to Pilate. Most of these men would have despised Pilate. He was one of the most cruel and hated men in all of Judea because of the way he treated the people and the way that he repeatedly defiled their religious sensitivities and the temple of Jerusalem. But they're playing to him here like, you know, like, oh, Pilate, our good friend, our good pal here. They need Pilate. They need him to sign off, so they pander to him even though they hated him. Their bias against Jesus had completely distorted their entire value system beyond what it already was. We find the same thing today. We find people making biased claims. People will lambast Jesus Christ or his followers in the public square, but it's often the case that the axe that they have to grind relates to the fact that Jesus has, by his word of truth, confronted and condemned their pet sins and their hypocrisy, just as Jesus did with the religious authorities of Jerusalem. Jesus said in John 3:19, light has come into the world, and men love darkness rather than light, for their deeds are evil. It may be the case that Christ and his sword-like word has cut against the grain of their treasured beliefs and traditions, and without even considering the possibility that Jesus could be speaking truth, they reject him. They'll say, for instance, you know, I don't believe the miracles of the Gospels. I don't believe Jesus ever did any of those things because miracles are impossible. Well, it is the impossibility of them that make them miracles. And if these things happened every day, well, they would be very irrelevant to the discussion. But it's the fact that they don't happen every day that make them worthy of our attention. Because here we have historical documents saying that they did happen. And if we cannot demonstrate that these documents are historically inaccurate, then we have to consider it at least a possibility that they did happen once. They did happen at one time in one season of the world's history. And if they did, then perhaps our presumption that miracles are impossible is premature. But rather than investigating those kinds of things for themselves, they write them off by preconceived biases that supernatural deeds are not possible in the world. Well, if you'd consider Jesus for yourself, you won't be persuaded by biased claims that people make against him. In Matthew 16, Jesus presented his disciples with two questions. You remember them? The first one was this: who do people say that the Son of Man is? That's an important question. Who do people you know say that Jesus is? But then the second question that Jesus said to his disciples in Matthew 16 was more important. Who do you say that I am? It ultimately doesn't matter what others say about Jesus. Their claims might be baseless. They might be biased. But you know, what matters infinitely here and now, and what will matter eternally when life comes to an end, is what do you say about Jesus? Each and every human being has to consider Christ for himself or herself. And in demanding to hear the evidence of the case presented before him, Pilate was off to a good start in doing just that. He says, I'm not going to listen to your claims. I want to hear the evidence for myself. But then he began to stumble. When they tried to backpedal out, Pilate says, well, then you just take him yourselves and you judge him according to your own law. He's trying to avoid making a verdict for himself. And when it comes to Jesus, that's something that is never afforded to any of us. You can't avoid making a verdict. You can't say, well, you guys just decide what you want to do with Jesus. I won't make a decision today. Oh, no. You have to make a decision. And that brings us to the second factor as we answer the question, what shall we do with Jesus? Secondly, we must be seekers of truth. We must consider him for ourselves, and we must be seekers of truth. I don't know if you ever watched the television show Columbo. I haven't seen that show in a long time. I used to watch reruns of it all the time. My dad was a detective, so every detective on TV, you know, I had to watch those things. But Columbo, you know, he was sort of an inept, bumbling, you know, detective. He was always kind of playing the fool in the investigation. But he always got his man. And the way he did it was by asking a lot of questions. Sometimes he'd just sort of innocently say, well, do you mind if I ask you a question? And then they'd talk about all sorts of things. And then he'd say, well, just one final question. Ha ha, and that was the one. That was the one with the hook in it. He'd get the right question asked, and he'd get the answers he was seeking. Now, in academics, sometimes in teaching, that this is a popular method. It's called the Socratic method. It's question and answer, named after the philosopher Socrates. That's because in Socrates' day, there was a popular group of philosophers called the Sophists. And the Sophists were known for being very persuasive, but they didn't have any substance to their argument. They persuaded people by their influential way of speaking, but there was nothing in the content of what they were saying. It's kind of like sometimes I've heard some preaching where a fellow would get really worked up and exert a lot of sweat and you know, there'd be a lot of loud hysterics going on, and people would leave and say, boy, that was a great sermon. And say, well, what was it about? I don't know, but it was really good, you know. Well, if you don't know what it was about, it wasn't that good. But, you know, that persuasive presentation draws you in. You're not even considering the content. Well, Socrates said, that's a problem. And so he began to engage his hearers in a dialogue, questions and answers. Yeah, asking the right questions is a great way to discover truth if we bring those questions to the right source. And Pilate seemed to know that. Unimpressed with what we might call the sophistry, just the empty rhetoric of the Jewish authorities. You know, hey, if we didn't do anything wrong, we wouldn't have brought him. Well, Pilate's not impressed by that. So he brings Jesus inside the praetorium and he begins to ask him several very important questions. Verse 33, are you the king of the Jews? Verse 35, what have you done? Friends, I'm going to suggest to you that those are the two most important questions that can ever be asked about Jesus. Who are you? What have you done? Now, Pilate didn't go out and take a popular opinion poll on these matters. You know, he didn't go around the countryside surveying people and, well, who do you think Jesus is and what do you think he's done? No, he went directly to the source. He did what we all must do. He brought those questions to Jesus to let Jesus answer them for himself. Who are you and what have you done? You notice in verse 34 that before answering Pilate, Jesus gets down to the motivation of the question. Are you saying this on your own initiative or did others tell you about me? The difference between those two is very significant. Throughout the Gospels, Jesus never turned away from anyone who is genuinely seeking truth for themselves. But Jesus also never wasted time or words engaging in an endless debate with people who were disinterested in truth or who were merely trying to trap Jesus with his own words. I mean, if Pilate is personally inquiring, then perhaps Jesus can lead him into a better or deeper understanding of who he is. But if he's just parroting what others have said, then Jesus knows that the deck is stacked against him already. And it's not that Jesus doesn't already know why Pilate's asking the question, but he's forcing Pilate, just as he forces all of us, to examine the motives of our inquiry. Why is it that we're curious about Jesus? Is it because we're just trying to rule him out, just trying to find liberty to lead our lives the way we want to lead them without his interference? Or are we genuinely curious, genuinely interested in knowing who he is? Well, Pilate tries to bob and weave here and maintain his slippery posture on the fence, and so he says in verse 35, "I'm not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and the chief priest delivered you to me." Essentially what he's saying is, why should I care? Now, I'm asking the questions, but I don't really care because I don't have a dog in this fight. I used that expression one time in Ukraine with my interpreter. He was trying to make a decision about something, and I said, "I don't have a dog in this fight." And my interpreter was very puzzled by that. There is no dogfight going on here, sir. let me explain this to you. And then that was the beginning of a week-long introduction to American English idioms to my interpreter. And when I got ready to leave the country, I said something to him, and he said, "Ah, that dog will not hunt." You know, he had learned. He'd come a long way as a student. But what Pilate's saying here is, look, I don't have a dog in this fight, okay? I don't care what becomes of you. But that position is impossible to maintain if we are seeking truth. Truth is something that cannot be studied with disinterest, because truth calls for an active response. Pilate can't get off the hook this easy, nor can anybody else. Everybody has a dog in this fight. You remember when Pilate asked the second question, he builds up to it and he says, "What have you done? What have you done? Why are you here before me? Why should I even be considering you? What have you done?" And Jesus now begins to answer both questions. He says, "My kingdom is not of this world." Well, there it is. You wanted to know if Jesus is a king? There it is. If he has a kingdom, then he's a king. He never denied that. Pilate said, "So you are a king." He says, "Well, you say correctly that I'm a king." But Jesus is clear to explain to Pilate what kind of kingship he has, what his kingdom is like. He's not come to overthrow Rome. That's not what Jesus came to do. He's not come to liberate Judea from Roman tyranny. No, in fact, those would be too small of a thing for a king whose kingdom is not of this world. He says, "If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting right now, but they're not." In fact, you remember that one of them had tried to start a fight, and Jesus rebuked him, and he healed the one whom Peter had struck with the sword. He prevented the fight to protect him. Kings of this world preserve their power by force. It's the way it works. But Jesus has no need to do that. His kingdom is not of this world. It's not established. It's not defended by force. His jurisdiction is universal. He has authority in heaven and on earth. And his mission is not to liberate one corrupt nation from another. It's not to throw off the shackles of one oppressive empire. It is to liberate the entire human race from the tyranny of sin and our enslavement to sin. So how does this king accomplish this? He says, "For this I've been born, and for this I've come into the world, to testify to the truth." His kingdom is established and advanced and defended by the power of his word. Those who hear his word and believe become citizens of this kingdom and are delivered from the powers of evil that are at work in this world. John will say later in 1 John chapter 5 and verse 4 that those who are born of God by faith overcome this world in the victory of Christ. So Jesus says here, "Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Understand the weightiness of this radical claim. Jesus is saying here to Pilate, I was born to be a king, but I'm not a king of this world. I'm a king of a whole other realm that knows no borders or boundaries. And this king is claiming that he came into the world to reveal the truth of God. He claims to be the complete revelation of who God is, and that apart from him, no one can know anything about God. That's bold. John 14:6, he said, I am the truth. You have to understand that these are radical claims, and they knock everybody off of the fence. You can't listen to claims like that and sit the fence. You've got to make a decision. C.S. Lewis famously said, the one thing you must never say about Jesus is that he's a merely great moral teacher. Lewis said, a man who was merely a man and said the sort of things that Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic or else he'd be the devil of hell. And so you have to make a choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. Lewis said, you can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and call him a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God, but let's not come with any of this patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher, because he hasn't left that option open to us. And that brings us to the final issue. When we answer the question, what shall we do with Jesus? We have to consider him for ourselves, and we have to seek truth. But thirdly, we have to follow truth wherever it leads us. The climactic courtroom scene in the movie A Few Good Men. You may recall that Tom Cruise's character exclaims to Jack Nicholson's character, I want the truth, and Nicholson boldly retorts back, you can't handle the truth. We're not talking about movies. We're talking about real life in the real world. And if you're going to seek truth, you have to ask yourself if you can handle the truth and handle where it's going to lead you. Truth will lead us to an inevitable decision. See, once truth is discovered, indifference is no longer an option. You have to decide to receive it or reject it. You can no longer sit the fence. And nowhere is this more vital than in the case of what we shall do with Jesus. Pilate has gone to the right source. He's asked the right questions. He's received the right answers. But he's still trying to sit the fence. And so he says abruptly to Jesus here, what is truth? And then he walks out. Verse 38, Pilate said to him, what is truth? And when he had said this, he went out. What is truth? And walks out the door. Carson says that this question comes because Pilate is either convinced that there is no answer or because he doesn't want to hear the answer. And in this way, we see in Pilate an almost prophetic image of our contemporary culture. The world today is defined by a way of thinking that's been called postmodernism. The last half century, this has been the predominant worldview, built on the presupposition that all truth is relative. There's no such thing as an absolute truth, a truth with a capital T that's true for all men at all times and all places. You know, people say things like, well, that may be true for you, but it's not for me. And so with truth being relative, then every person can decide for himself what's right and what's wrong. And if you choose to judge my standards by your standards, then I can label you with that most heinous placard of our day and say that you are intolerant. You are intolerant. Friends, it's utterly impossible to build or live a life on that kind of shifting foundation. I mean, do you understand that even when somebody says that there is no absolute truth, they are making a statement that they wish for you to believe is absolutely true? There's no absolute truth. Is that absolutely true? I mean, that's an absolute truth claim, is it not? And when they say that, you know, there are no standards of morality, that itself is a standard of morality. And the person who tries to thrust that standard upon you is no different than a person who says, you know, well, the Ten Commandments are the standard of morality, and I'm going to thrust that upon you. It's impossible to deny for long in the real world that there are standards and absolutes. There's right, there's wrong, there's truth and falsehood. There is truth and error. Truth with a capital T is unavoidable and impossible to ignore. Perhaps, as Carson suggests, Pilate knows that, but he just doesn't want to hear the truth. He can't handle the truth. The fact is that we all have an innate knowledge of God. We all have an innate knowledge of truth and right and wrong. I mean, if you don't believe that, consider how you would act if somebody stole something that belonged to you. I mean, immediately you would say, well, that's not right. Well, what kind of standard are you appealing to? I mean, the thief may say, sure it is. I can do anything I want. And you might say, well, that's not true. And the thief could say, well, it might not be true for you, but it's true for me. And then you would say, well, that's not fair. And ultimately, you find yourself caught in the trap of trying to simultaneously affirm and deny the existence of these very same standards. Could it be that we've spent much of our lives trying to avoid the responsibility that the truth of God brings to bear upon our souls? The Apostle Paul in Romans 1 speaks of people who know the truth but who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. When truth speaks harsh words about our sin and about our unbelief, we have a decision to make. We can reject our sin and our unbelief and turn to the truth, or we can reject the truth and turn afresh to our sin and unbelief. Like Pilate, you can try to dismiss this notion of truth, but soon you'll be hung on your own noose, because dismissing truth doesn't make it go away, nor does it exempt any of us from accountability to it. If we're committed to seeking truth, then we have to follow it all the way to the inevitable decision to accept it, to surrender to it, to conform our lives to it, or else to willingly and openly live in rebellion to it. And if truth is found in the person of Jesus Christ, then life, death, heaven, and hell are at stake in the decision. And so to not decide is to decide. And that decision could well be eternally disastrous. So what this means is that in the pursuit of truth, we have to follow it all the way where it leads, even in knowing that it's going to bring us to a place of inevitable decision. But it may well lead us to an unpopular position. Pilate had all the information to make the right decision, and he almost did. He went out on his portico and he announced the verdict. He said, I find no guilt in him. But because Pilate's power and prestige rested upon maintaining order in the land, when people began to cry out against his decree, he began to waffle, and he gave in to the demands of the horde surrounding him. He had followed the right course, he'd asked the right questions, he'd arrived at the right conclusions, but then he cowered under pressure and sent the Son of God to the cross. Friends, you should be aware, if you decide to cast your lot with Jesus in life, it may prove unpopular to the people surrounding you. But you must never fear truth or where it leads you. Romans chapter 10, verse 11 says, whoever believes in him will not be disappointed. You might be unpopular. Things might get uncomfortable, but ultimately and eternally, you will not be disappointed. You will find satisfaction nowhere else than in the truth of God embodied in the person of Jesus Christ. I mean, you should know how Pilate's story ends. Not recorded in the Bible, but the secular historians point out the rest of his story. He waffles here to save his own skin at the expense of the life of Christ, but within a short time, his determination to preserve himself led him to order the bloody massacre of a multitude of Samaritans. Uprising after that got the attention of Rome, and they brought him back from his post, brought him home to Rome in shame, and it was not long after that, unable to bear the shame, that Pilate took his own life. His efforts to preserve his power, his prestige, his image destroyed him. His earthly kingdom was threatened by the eternal kingdom of Jesus, and in seeking to save it, he lost it forever. And the same will be true for us. If we ignore truth as a measure to secure the sovereignty that we want to have over our own lives, our kingdom will come toppling down around us like so many castles of sand. Jesus said, if you seek to save your life, you'll lose it. But if you're willing to lose it for my sake, you will find it. And you will find it abundant and eternal in him, because he is the truth. And so the question for us all is not what others think about Jesus or what others are saying about him, but what shall we do with Jesus? We have to decide that for ourselves, and we have to seek the truth and be committed to following that truth to the inevitable decisions and the unpopular positions that truth will lead us to. So what shall you do with Jesus? Let's pray.